Anatomy and Physiology, Gulf Coast State College. Today we're going to discuss the blood vessels, beginning with just some basic anatomy and physiology. But I can't get past this first slide without looking at that figure supplied with your textbook materials off to the right. Surely your book could have done a little bit better than that. One thing's for sure, this gentleman looks awfully proud to be showing off his blood vessels. That being said, let's move on. Blood vessels. What's the short story? Here it is on the top. It is a closed system of tubes that carries blood away from the heart, then to body tissues, and then back to the heart. That's the short story. That's the big picture that you should know. But of course, we're going to learn a lot more details than that, and there's even occasionally an exception to the rule. What's the purpose of this stuff? Well, it's similar to what we talked about when we talked about blood. The short story is in with the good, out with the bad. In other words, we're going to transport nutrients to the tissue cells and take away the waste. Same thing with gases, in with the oxygen, out with the carbon dioxide. We break down the blood vessels into five major types. Number one, we start with something called arteries. What does artery mean? Does artery always mean red blood? Well, almost always, but there's an exception we'll talk about. What artery really means is away from the heart. And I have an easy way to remember that. A for artery, A for away. Next comes arterioles. Arterial means small artery, and that's exactly what they are. Then comes my favorite of all, I think the most important of all the blood vessels, called the capillaries. Followed by something called venules, and all venule means is little vein. And then the fifth type of blood vessel is called a vein. And what does vein mean? Does vein always mean blue blood? Well, almost always, but not always. There is an exception to the rule we'll talk about. What vein really means is towards the heart. Veins move blood towards the heart. And what I do to remember that is I take my two hands, I put my fingertips together, and I make a V with my hands. And then I aim that V right towards that heart. And that reminds me, vein means take blood towards the heart. On this slide, we're going to take a look at the basic structure of a blood vessel wall. We're going to notice that there are three basic layers to the wall. As we study this, you will notice that there are, of course, many similarities, but also some differences between arteries and veins. It's those differences that you really need to take note of, not just for testing purposes. It's because if something has a different design, it's because it probably has a different function or a different mission. And that's the beauty of anatomy and physiology. The design matches the purpose. Notice over here to your left, we have an artery, and over here to your right, we have a vein. Let's go ahead and take a look at the three basic layers from inside to out, and then we'll break them down. First, notice the word tunica. Tunica just means a coat. Don't let that word freak you out. It's just one of those Greek root words you should know. If you were ever in a fraternity in college, maybe you went to some parties called tunic parties, right? A tunic or toga? Tunic, toga, same thing. It means a coat. So whenever you see the word tunic, it just means a coat. Let's start on the inside of the blood vessel wall with the tunica interna. It means the internal coat of the blood vessel wall. The two pieces of the tunica interna the arteries and veins have in common are, number one, these simple squamous epithelial cells that, when they are located as a lining of our cardiovascular system, they are called endothelium. Just outside of that, we have a wrapping of what's shown here as a light orange connective tissue. This is the basement membrane. Remember that name because there are some very important diseases that affect the basement membrane. Next coming up is a red arrow going to fly up from the bottom of your screen and label the internal elastic lamina, only seen in arteries. What is it? Well, it is what it says it is. Lamina means a layer. Elastic means it's made up of elastic tissue, like elastic fibers. And it has a special purpose in arteries. It allows them to flex and snap back like a rubber band. So the design matches the mission. Next layer is the middle layer that some genius called the tunica media. It means the middle layer. And the middle layer is made of muscle. Smooth muscle, of course. Involuntary muscle. Easy to remember for test 8. Muscle, M. Tunica media, M. Notice also the differences. In general, arteries have much thicker smooth muscle in the media than do veins. And the amount of muscle in the tunica media in arteries can vary quite widely depending on the purpose of that artery. Up will come an arrow again from the bottom, red arrow labeling the external elastic lamina. Please note again, it's only in arteries, giving that artery more elastic tissue, more elastic fibers, so it has a special property and a special purpose that we'll talk about shortly. The last of the three coats is the outermost one called the tunica externa. It just means the external coat. It's just made up of basically connective tissue. Also notice something we have in common. The interior of both arteries and veins has a name. It's called the lumen. That's anatomy 101. You should know that backwards and forwards. The name for the opening of almost any hollow or tubular organ in anatomy can be called a lumen. So that's something they have in common. Let's take a look over to the right at this vein, because it has some extra things labeled here that you don't see on the artery slide. We have valves. That's right. Veins have lots of valves. What for? I mean, just because someone said, I think I'll put valves there? No, you'll see that valves serve a purpose, just like in the heart. Valves are to allow one-way direction of blood flow back to the heart. And notice that these valves are made up of endothelium. So what were the differences? Main differences are the walls of the artery had elastic tissue to allow them to snap back and forth like a rubber band. The wall of the artery also had more smooth muscle in the media, and the veins have a lot of valves. Some of you might be looking at this slide and saying, man, you know, I can remember that, but this is nitty gritty. I'll never see it in real life. I'll give an example of something. Take a look at that elastic lamina. There's a disease, and you could do an internet search on it, called giant cell arteritis, also called temporal arteritis. It's a disease where you get giant cells in the walls of the arteries. Specifically, often tends to affect that internal elastic lamina. And what happens is it could swell the artery shut so much that it could cause death from heart attack, or it can cause blindness. I saw several cases of blindness from a disease of the elastic lamina called giant cell arteritis. So yeah, this stuff is real. Let's take a look now at a breakdown of some different types of vessels. I want to start with the biggest ones called elastic arteries. Why do you think they're called elastic arteries? Because they're elastic. They can snap back and forth like a rubber band because they got a lot of elastic tissue and elastic fibers. They're also called conducting arteries. Why? Because they conduct blood away from the heart to major places. So they have a big job in conducting that blood away from the heart and on their long journey throughout the body. The two main examples you should know for sure are, number one, the aorta. That's the one all books use as an example. That's, of course, the big honking vessel coming out the left ventricle. The other one you should know that's not shown on this diagram, however, is the pulmonary trunk. The pulmonary trunk and arteries are elastic arteries that come out of the right ventricle. How they work and what's the purpose of having all that elastic tissue? Well, let's look at the picture from your book. Here is the aorta coming out of the left ventricle. On the picture to the left, we show the left ventricle undergoing contraction, that is systole, forcing blood out the aortic valve and into the aorta and along its journey throughout the body's capillaries. But notice also what's happening. It's stretching the elastic walls of the huge honking aorta. Why? So that even during ventricular relaxation, diastole, the walls of the aorta snap back a bit, so we have an extra oomph, an extra push of blood, so blood flow continues towards the capillaries even during ventricular relaxation because of the special elastic properties of the aorta. So therefore, we kind of rehashing that bottom bullet point on the slide. Yes, the elastic arteries, they store and release pressure energy. They are a source of potential energy. We call these a pressure reservoir because they're a reservoir or a source of potential pressure energy. Next, we'll take a look at some muscular arteries. This is a gorgeous light micrograph showing a transverse section through a muscular artery. And sure enough, in the tunica media, we have a whole bunch of nice, thick, smooth muscle. Why are they called muscular arteries? Well, you guessed it, because they have a lot of smooth muscle in the tunica media. They're also known as distributing arteries because they distribute the blood throughout the body. For example, they distribute blood to many of our major organs. Because of the muscle in the muscular arteries, they are capable of a lot of both vasoconstriction and vasodilation. That's what allows them to adjust blood flow and distribute blood to organs as and where and when needed. The muscle in muscular arteries also allows these vessels to maintain something called vascular tone. Just like when you sit in your chairs, you're not consciously thinking of it, but some muscles are alternately kind of relaxing and contracting to maintain posture in your chairs. You could kind of think of vascular tone like vascular posture, and we have to sit with a normal level of tone in these blood vessels to maintain homeostasis. Give you an example of what happens if we lose that tone. Something called feigning. The technical term is syncope. And syncope, by the way, if you want to look it up, is S-Y-N-C-O-P-E. It just means fainting. And what happens is sometimes the vessels abnormally dilate, then the blood rushes away from our head and we pass out. So that's the importance of this structure and of this particular function. Next, let's talk about arterioles. Remember, arterioles are just small arteries. So they're similar to the above, but they're smaller. Arterioles are also known as resistance vessels. Why are they called resistance vessels? Because they have resistance, because they're smaller. It's like trying to blow through a smaller straw. There's more friction, there's more resistance. And when you have more resistance, it kind of slows things down a little bit, doesn't it? And the key point of this is our arterioles, our resistance vessels, help to regulate flow into the all-important capillaries. And it's nice to kind of start to slow things down with these resistance vessels as we approach our capillary beds. I'll tell you the importance of that coming up shortly. But first, some gross anatomy. What a gorgeous picture of the upper extremity, showing you some of our muscular distributing arteries. Here's a brachial artery and also a radial artery right over, of course, the radius. This whole PowerPoint, when you review it, will show you the beauty of having learned the muscles and the bones first, because when you go to naming vessels at the end of this PowerPoint, you'll see how things match up so beautifully. Now we're going to talk about my favorite vessel. I hate to pick favorites, but I'm going to pick a favorite. Capillaries are my favorite. I love the capillaries because they have such a key function. They are also known as exchange vessels. Why do you think they're called exchange vessels? Well, because this is where the exchange takes place. This is where we have the in with the good, the out with the bad. Nutrients, waste, gases, changing places. Yes, they are the smallest of all the blood vessels. As a matter of fact, all they are made up of is two things, if I ask you. Number one, just this pink endothelium, and then on the outside of that, a very thin wrapping of light orange connective tissue, in this drawing anyway, called the basement membrane. Why should you care about this basement membrane I keep bringing up? Because, for example, in diabetes, which is very common, I bet everyone knows somebody, a friend, a loved one who has it. Diabetes hammers away at the basement membrane of our capillaries. And capillaries are almost everywhere. And the problem is, if you ruin the capillaries, like to the brain and to the heart and the eyes and the kidneys, that's how diabetics end up with things like heart attacks and blindness and kidney failure. So yes, this is critical to know. The capillaries are our connection between our small arteries called arterioles and our small veins called venules. It is the central part of what we call our microcirculation, and that should be easy to remember for the test. If I ask you what the main central part of the microcirculation is, micro sounds small, and capillaries are the smallest blood vessels, so hopefully you'll tell me the capillaries are the main central part of the microcirculation. Last point on this slide is very interesting to me. Capillaries, of course, reach out and touch almost every cell in the human body. They have to, because we need the in with the good, out with the bad thing. But there are some exceptions to the rule, and I want you to know those exceptions. So let's fill in the blanks together. What does not have capillary blood supply? In the first slot, I want you to write the cornea and the lens of the eye. In the second slot, I want you to write epithelial tissues. And in the third slot, I want you to write down our old friend, cartilage. Remember, cartilage is avascular. I want to talk about the clinical significance of what I just stated. The cornea and the lens in the eye don't have vessels. That's actually a good thing, because if there were blood vessels in the cornea, which is the front dome-shaped clear window to the eye that you see in the mirror, and if there were blood vessels in your lens, you probably couldn't see through them. So that's one reason there are no vessels there. Then you might be asking, how do those things get the exchange of gases or goodies and waste and things like that? Well, let me use the cornea for an example. We can get, of course, oxygen from the outside world, because the cornea faces the outside world. And on the inside of the cornea, there's actually fluid behind there that also helps with the exchange of nutrients and wastes. That reminds me of something clinically relevant. What about contact lenses? Anybody have an issue or a concern about slapping a contact lens on the front of a cornea that has no blood vessels? Well, yeah, of course. It can interfere with the exchange of gases, the oxygen in particular. And that's why companies that make contact lenses over the decades have put billions of dollars of effort into inventing contact lenses that improve exchange of gases. In the old days, you couldn't wear a contact lens very long before it physically hurt and physiologically damaged the eye. But these days, technology is so advanced that there's some contact lenses, I heard them advertise on TV, that you can wear for up to a month. Well, anyway, you still have to keep in the back of your mind that when you slap something on that surface of the eye, it is still going to have some kind of effect. What about epithelium being avascular? That's right. Like the surface of my skin, that's why little Mikey in the third grade, there was always little Mikey in the third grade trying to freak you out with something. He would take like a little needle and thread it through a couple of times through the superficial part of his skin. And he didn't bleed and didn't feel that much either, because there's no blood vessels there. So that's how little Mikey could do that and freak you out. And what about cartilage? Remember, please try not to damage your cartilage. If your patient's cartilage is damaged, very hard to fix, even with new technology, because of lack of blood supply. Remember, blood, in with the good, out with the bad. Hard to heal tissue without a good blood supply. this slide here emphasizes something important that I want you to know for our course. I'm sort of ratcheting things up a notch, but I'm also getting you ready for more advanced things in anatomy and physiology. One of the things I like to say to my students is, if they do not know the blood supply to an organ, they do not know how it works. And you'll see how true that is over and over and over again. Whether it be a liver, whether it be a pituitary gland, whether it be a uterus, whether it be a heart, I don't care what it is. If you don't know the blood supply of something, you don't know how it works. So let's look at some specific capillaries and how and where they function. First up top, this is the type of capillary we see in most of our body tissues. Notice that it has small clefts between the endothelial cells. They are called intercellular clefts. A cleft is a space, like a cleft palate has a space between the palate. Inter means in between, cell means cell. Most capillaries have small spaces between the endothelial cells. In English, what I'm saying and what you need to know is capillaries are leaky. They are not watertight. If they were watertight, that would massively inhibit our ability to exchange things and perform other functions that we talked about, protective functions such as blood clotting, such as protection from infection. So all capillaries leak. Let's move down here one in the middle of your figure. This is a capillary I want you to know that you see in the kidney. Look at the style of endothelial cell we have here. Looks like Swiss cheese. Those are little holes that some genius called pores. There are pores in the endothelial cells of capillaries in the kidneys. Kidneys would not be able to do their job of filtering blood into urine if they didn't have those pores. So that's why it's important to know. Last on this slide, check that capillary out on the bottom. Man, that thing got all kind of spaces in it. I mean, the basement membrane doesn't even wrap all the way around. There are huge, large intercellular clefts. These are the leakiest of all capillaries. They leak like a sieve, and they have to work where they're going to work, which you should know. We have these leakiest of all blood vessels with large intercellular clefts in the red bone marrow, the liver, and the spleen. Why? Just for fun, someone said, I'll make it that way? No, because of the purpose. Remember, in the red bone marrow, that's where we make blood cells. And they wouldn't be able to get out of the bone marrow and into our blood vessels unless we had some really leaky capillaries in the red bone marrow. And we do. Same thing with the liver and the spleen. We're going to learn the liver and the spleen do all kind of functions, including filtering the blood. And we couldn't filter and clean the crud out of the blood unless we had these big spaces. So that's the importance of this slide. Kind of a summary here, nothing really new. On the top, a little drawing to your right, it's showing the heart, and blood is going away from the heart through arteries, of course. We're showing exchange of gases between the blood capillaries and the tissue cells, and then we're returning the blood back to the heart through the venous system. But what's really cool to me is down below here in the light micrograph, 600 power shows you a capillary, super thin wall. Remember, only endothelium and basement membrane, barely big enough to let one single file of a red blood cell at a time get through. You see those beautiful biconcave discs with their strong but flexible plasma membranes making their way through the tiniest of capillaries to reach out and touch almost every tissue cell in the human body. How do we control capillary blood flow? I mean, there are times when we are going to want more blood supply to a tissue, and there are times when we're going to want less blood supply to a tissue, for example. So you have to know how we control it. On this slide, it's trying to show you, here's an arteriole up top in red, Down below, there's a venule. Of course, in between is the capillary bed, which is the main central part of our microcirculation. How do we control blood flow? Well, I want you to know we have these special bands of smooth muscle called pre-capillary sphincters. They are what and where they say they are. Entering into the capillary bed, we got little circles of muscles that are sphincter muscles. You know what sphincters do when they contract? They kind of clamp things down. What controls the sphincter muscle? How do we adjust blood flow to organs and tissues as necessary? Well, you can always give the same one-word answer. Remember, the first day of class, I gave it all away. Gave away all my secrets the first day. If mommy or daddy ever asked you how this, that, or the other thing works, you could always say neuroendocrine control. That means between a combination of nerves and hormones, they control everything. I mean all the way from the biggest process you could think about all the way down to the teeny-weeny metabolic processes. Nothing happens without nerves and hormones. So look, off to your right, if we want to cut down blood supply to a tissue for whatever reason, we constrict the precapillary sphincter. If we want to open up the blood supply to that capillary bed in a tissue, we relax the sphincter and we have nice blood flow, all under neuroendocrine control. Where's blood located? So the title of this slide is blood distribution. It means where is blood located in our body? Well, here's the story, and maybe surprising to most of you. The largest portion of our blood volume, when we're just hanging out at rest, is in our systemic veins and venules. In other words, it's mostly in our veins. As shown down here in this pie graph, most of the blood at rest is in our veins and our venules. As a matter of fact, you should know more specifically that our blood reservoirs, that's right, our extra storage house of blood that we can get when we need it, are in the veins, specifically, mostly, of the dermis and also in the abdominal organs, especially the spleen and the liver. And then when we need that blood, that sort of warehouse or reservoir of blood, we can vasoconstrict the blood vessels. That means we clamp down and squish down on the blood vessels in those reservoirs, squish the blood out of those reservoirs, and aim it towards other organs that really need it. Let me give you some examples. Let's say you have somebody who's faced with an attacker. You know, they're about to be assaulted. Where do you need blood at that moment? Well, you need blood in your skeletal muscles and your heart because you're either going to fight or you're going to run. And what happens is, yes, under neuroendocrine control, that blood is going to be diverted by vasoconstriction away from things like your skin, which is going to turn white, isn't it, when you get scared, away from your guts, away from your urinary system, because there's no time to be eating a cheeseburger and drinking a Pepsi if you're about to be assaulted. And we're going to divert that blood from those abdominal organs and from the skin, and we're going to shoot it to the skeletal muscles and the heart muscle where you need it. I'm going to tell you a true story maybe while you're making notes on this slide. It's about the spleen. The spleen happens to be the most commonly injured intra-abdominal organ during trauma cases like car accidents. And in the old days, we went ahead, if the spleen was ruptured or lacerated, we just immediately took it out, emergency surgery, or else the patient would bleed to death. When I was a third-year med student, unbeknownst to me, there was this surgeon who always did this trick to all the fresh medical students. So he did a splenectomy, he took the spleen out, put it on the table next to the operating table, and then when I wasn't ready, he took a syringe of epinephrine, which does serve as a hormone, and he took this epinephrine or adrenaline, and right at the correct time, he squirted it into the spleen, all the vessels in the spleen vasoconstricted, and the blood squished out of the splenic artery all over the place. And he proved to me the words that are on this slide are true. I mean, that spleen just contracted down, vasoconstricted, and squirted the blood everywhere. Now, that was decades ago. It wasn't around here, so don't try to find out. And, of course, you can never get away with that these days because of blood and body fluid precautions. There'd be lawsuits flying all over the place. But I never forgot the principle of a blood reservoir. And the story is, let's say you have a patient with a stab wound to the right arm and they're losing a lot of blood. What will happen is the adrenaline inside that person's body will go sky high. It will go to the spleen. The spleen is like a bag of blood. It will constrict and all the blood will get squished out. And it's almost like you get an instant mini transfusion from that blood reservoir that we call the spleen. So I think that's pretty cool stuff. Well, we have to talk about checking circulation because this is something we've all had checked, right? Everyone's had their pulse checked. Maybe you've checked someone's pulse. If you're going to be a healthcare provider, you're going to do it 100 billion times a day. What is the pulse? First of all, what makes a pulse? A pulse is due to expansion and recoil of the elastic arteries, which leads to a traveling pressure wave that you could feel as a pulse. Where do you normally check the pulse? May as well touch on it here. Of course, you'll learn how to check it properly when you get into healthcare. Usually, you check it in the extremities. Most commonly, the upper extremity. You check it in the radial artery, which you guessed it is over the radius. You can also check it in the elbow region and the arm region, in the brachial artery. In the lower extremity, you may check it on the top of the foot. The top of the foot, remember, that's the dorsal part of the foot. There's an artery there called the dorsalis pedis artery. Ped, root word, means foot. Dorsal, as you know, means the top of the foot. So it's the artery on top of the foot. That's a common place to check for a pulse. Also, remember, behind the knee is the fossa called the popliteal fossa. It's that divot right in between the tendons of your hammies. Inside there is an artery that's conveniently called the popliteal artery. That's another place to check a pulse. If you can't feel a pulse there, you can move more proximally and check the big honking femoral artery as well. Other places, your book says you can check a pulse. Yeah, you could check it in the facial artery. I rarely see it checked there. You could also check it in the temporal artery superficially. Occasionally, I've seen it checked there. More commonly, though, these days, they have those temporal scanners for checking the body temperature. They're fairly accurate for checking temperature in this region because that artery with its warm blood is so superficial there. And then your book says you can check the common carotid artery, but I got a red star on that, and I want you to be careful there because here's the deal. Normally, we like to check the pulse in a peripheral location, most typically in the upper extremity, as we discussed. But you might not always feel it there because maybe the person's blood pressure is low, maybe their vital signs are dropping, maybe they're losing a lot of body fluid and volume, maybe they're developing shock. And you'll know that as the blood pressure gets lower and lower and lower, you'll have to move closer and closer and closer to the heart in order to be able to feel a pulse. The deal with checking the pulse in the common carotid artery, however, is this. If you press on the common carotid artery, there are special pressure sensors in there that we've discussed and or will discuss that sense blood pressure. And if they sense too much pressure, they send a signal to the brain that says, hey, calm the blood pressure down because I don't want to, you know, burst the capillaries in my skull. So if you press on the carotid artery too hard, you're going to drop their blood pressure. You can even make them pass out. Furthermore, in elderly patients, they often have cholesterol clots in there, and you certainly don't want to break one loose by mashing on the carotid artery. We're typically only checking carotid artery pulses when someone's in cardiovascular collapse, maybe, you know, CPR, that's where you check it because that's where, you know, kind of like your last ditch effort to even find one is. And then, of course, I've seen this, and I can't believe it when I do. Never, ever, ever check the carotid artery pulse on both sides at the same time. Because you're almost guaranteed by pressing on both carotid arteries at the same time and mashing on the pressure sensors, you're going to drop their blood pressure and they're going to pass out right in front of you. And again, you might cause them a stroke. So don't mash on both carotids at the same time. I know what some of you are thinking. Some of you are Star Trek fans. How did Spock do it? Well, maybe it was something like this. I don't know. Maybe Spock and Star Trek knew exactly how to press on that pressure sensor there and make someone pass out. But you shouldn't be doing that at home, for sure. Don't do anything I ever say to do, by the way. Just learn the material. Well, we got to talk about blood pressure, of course. How do you measure it? Well, with something called a sphygmomanometer. Yeah, that's a mouthful. I have a picture of a modern one, at least at the time of this recording, down to your lower right, a digital one. In the old days, of course, we had the cuff around the sleeve with a little dial on it and, you know, had to use a stethoscope. Normal blood pressure, generally in that 120 to 80 range. The top number is called the systolic blood pressure. It correlates with ventricular systole or contraction, normally, again, about 120. The bottom number that you see there, 80, that's the diastolic blood pressure. It correlates with ventricular diastole or ventricular relaxation. The difference between the 120 and the 80, in other words, you subtract the two, that number in this case would be 40. That difference is called the pulse pressure, and you should be familiar with that. And these numbers typically go in a ratio. It's called the 3-2-1 rule, I guess. In other words, the ratio of systolic to diastolic to pulse pressure is 3-2-1. In our example I just gave, remember, it was 120 over 80 with a pulse pressure of 40. And if you do the math, you do the ratio, that's 3-2-1. Okay, who cares? How can that help you? Well, you will learn as you advance in medicine that if people have, for example, a really abnormally high pulse pressure, that can mean bad diseases like of the heart valves or maybe a defect in the septum of the heart. So yes, this is real life, real deal stuff to be familiar with. What affects blood flow? Well, let's talk about the factors that affect blood flow. We already talked about one of them. Of course, blood pressure is one of the main factors. We have a closed circulatory system and it's pressurized with the pump we call the heart. But how does the blood know which way to flow? Here's the deal. You must have a high and a low pressure end in order to have flow in the closed circulatory system. And the key bullet point is to take home forever, that will help you figure out a lot of cardiovascular physiology, is blood flows from areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure. Same thing you learned in the heart with triple stars. What else affects blood flow? Well, something we call vascular resistance. And it really kind of is what it says it is. No better way to demonstrate this than by example. The narrower and the longer the tube, the more resistance. Instead of talking about blood vessels, let me use straws. Let's take two straws, first of all, of the same length. Let's say you have a thick straw and you blow through that. It's easy. Then you take a straw of the same length, but a small diameter, like one of the little swizzle sticks you use in your coffee. Try to blow through that thing. There's a lot more friction, a lot more resistance in that small blood vessel, so it's harder to flow through there. Also, the longer the straw, the more resistance. I mean, let's take two straws of the same diameter. And now let's have a real short one, like 1 inch. That's easy to blow through that. Then have another straw 10 foot long. Try to blow through that. You're going to hit a lot of resistance, a lot of friction. It's going to be hard and slow to get blood to flow through that puppy. Of course, in the blood vessel, we have to recall our processes of vasoconstriction and vasodilation. When we, you know, constrict or dilate that tube, that massively affects the resistance. Again, the tighter we squeeze down, the more the resistance, and the harder and slower to get that blood flow to roll through. Example at the bottom of the slide, and you don't have to memorize the math. It says here, if the diameter of the blood vessel decreases by half, the resistance to blood flow increases 16 times. I don't want you to know the math equation. I just want you to know that a little bit of change in diameter results in a big, ginormous change in resistance to blood flow. How does that help us in the real world? Well, two examples at the bottom. One is hardening of the arteries. You know, start to build up cholesterol and thicken and harden the walls of those arteries. Well, what happens as we get older and get high cholesterol? Well, we'll also start to get high blood pressure because you're making more resistance in that narrower tube that we call a blood vessel. And that, of course, leads to other diseases, increases our chances of things like heart attacks and strokes and so forth. What about excess adipose tissue? More fat. You know, obesity is a health concern. And believe it or not, for every 2 pounds of fat that we gain, we also gain 400 miles of blood vessels. Almost unbelievable, but it's true. You can look it up. And that has to deal with the longer tube issue we talked about. So if we add 400 miles of blood vessels because we're gaining 2 more pounds of fat, well, that's going to lead to increased blood pressure. That's why as we gain weight, we are at higher risk of high blood pressure, which again leads to other disorders such as heart attack and stroke. This reminds me of something we mentioned during the tissue part of this course. Please don't forget that adipose tissue is richly supplied with blood vessels. Some doctors forgot this when they were doing liposuction in their office and they ran into a complication and people died right on the table, right in front of their eyes because they bled out during the liposuction. Nothing new on this slide, just a graph showing you what we already talked about. Blood flows from what? Areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure. Here it shows you off to your left the pressure in the cardiovascular system. As an example, it's going from 0 at the bottom to 140 on the top of this vertical scale. And then across the bottom of the graph, horizontally, we're going in order away from the heart through the aorta, arteries, arterioles, capillaries, then back to the heart through venules, veins, and the vena cava. And notice the blood's flowing from high pressure to low pressure. It's showing our sort of our mean or average arterial pressure exiting the heart is right around 80. Then it's dipping down in the capillary bed where I have a star to around 25 or 30. And then it's ending up right at about 0. That's right. It's almost a pressure of 0 by the time you hit that right atrium and right ventricle. And so that's why blood flows in the right direction, because it's flowing from high pressure to low pressure. Take note of where I have that star under capillaries, though. I want you to know that average human capillary blood pressure is roughly in the 25 to 35 range, and that is clinically important. Don't do what I'm about to tell you. Don't do anything I ever say to do. Just learn the material. But if I were to press on my nails right now on my finger, I can actually compress the capillary beds underneath my nail. I can kind of blanch them out, make them turn white. I'm closing them off with very little pressure. It's actually a way you'll use to determine the cardiovascular status of some of your patients. But the point I want to hit on is that pressure in your capillary beds is pretty low. I just proved to myself I could occlude them fairly easily. And when your patients are in the hospital and the doctor writes an order to please get Mrs. Jones out of bed and walking around 4 times a day, please don't ignore that order. Because if they sit in one position too long, what's going to happen? They're going to close the capillary beds off to the skin in their buttocks or the skin in their heel. And if I cut off the blood supply to that tissue, what's going to happen? It's going to die. And they're going to get something called a pressure ulcer. And whose fault is that? That's almost always your fault. And you will never win in front of a jury of your peers. The lawyers will be all over you on that one. Now we're going to review something called venous return, because as we just mentioned, once you hit the venous part of the vascular system, not a really lot of high pressure in there as far as flow goes from the heart. So besides the heart, we need a little extra help. And so there are two other mechanisms that help pump blood from the lower body, especially to the heart. Those two pumps are, in order, number one, the skeletal muscle pump, and then we'll talk about next the respiratory pump. But each one of those pumps relies on something special that we have lots of in veins called valves. That's right, remember valves. They allow for one-way directional blood flow and they do not let things go backwards if they're working properly. Off to your right is a dissection of the real thing, trying to show you some valves in a real human vein. So they're cool to look at. We're going to check out the pumps, but first let's take a look at the valves inside the vein, because each of the pumps, of course, relies on these valves. To your upper left is a drawing of a normal vein. It's showing you a valve, and once blood gets above the valve, it can't go backwards because if it tries to, the valve leaflets or cusps, I should say, close together tightly and we can't go backwards. If we have a damaged valve called an incompetent valve, like in varicose veins, unfortunately the blood can go backwards through the valve and that can cause problems. Check out the real picture to your right of a patient with some pretty serious varicose veins. They're twisted, they're dilated, but it's not just the appearance. This can actually be painful, so painful it may require surgery. The vessels can also leak. That can also cause damage that you'll learn about in the future. So this is a real thing to be aware of and to learn. Where else can we get varicose veins? Well, around the anus and the anal canal, they're called hemorrhoids. That's often due to straining at bowel movements. You know, mama said don't strain at bowel movements, and mommy was right, or else you might get hemorrhoids. Another place you get varicose veins is in the esophagus. That's usually in alcoholics who have bad liver disease, and those are called, again, esophageal varices. Alcoholics can sometimes bleed out from those and die. So yes, you should know about veins. You should know about varicose veins. Now that we covered the veins, we talk about the skeletal muscle pump. We got some drawings down below of the leg. And in a nutshell, what it's trying to show you is when our skeletal muscles contract, what it does is it pushes the blood above the next valve up in the chain. But when the muscles relax, the blood can't go down or can't go backwards because the valve snaps shut and prevents it from going the wrong way. This is a great time to talk about something clinically relevant to this. I want y'all to know what a DVT is. A DVT is a deep vein thrombosis. Remember, a thrombosis is a blood clot that forms in an unbroken blood vessel. It normally forms in the deep leg veins. The typical story is somebody was laying in the hospital bed too long and you weren't getting them up walking around, or they're sitting on a long car ride or long plane ride and are not getting up and walking around every couple hours like we're supposed to, so you develop the blood clot. As a matter of fact, some studies I've read say that there are over 500,000 cases a year of DVT in the United States. And the problem is if that blood clot breaks off and becomes a thromboembolus, it can embolize to the lungs. There we call it a pulmonary embolus. And that could kill you if we block off blood flow, of course, to the lungs. As a matter of fact, some statistics say that up to 250,000 people a year in the United States die of a pulmonary embolism. Again, another example of why we're learning this stuff. Not just to get an A, but to help people. You'll learn how to do things to decrease chances of things like DVT and pulmonary embolus. The second pump to talk about that helps the venous blood flow in the right direction towards the heart is the respiratory pump. Let me try to just be simplified here with these drawings. To your upper left, let's say this is someone just in a normal kind of state sitting there. There's the diaphragm in this red line, a dome-shaped muscle, as you know. Here's the two lungs in the thoracic cavity. When we inhale, when we breathe in, the diaphragm goes down. That's right, it pushes downwards. And what happens? When that diaphragm pushes downwards, it increases pressure in the abdominopelvic cavity, and it causes a relatively decreased or almost negative sucking pressure in the thoracic cavity. And how does blood flow again? From areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure. So when you take that breath in, what it does is blood gets forced from the abdominopelvic cavity up past veins into the thoracic cavity towards the heart, which is our end game. Also, very important to talk about velocity of blood flow. At first glance, you might be thinking, why should I care about the speed of blood flow? Well, here it comes. You should know that speed is slowest where the total cross-sectional area is greatest. Huh, what does that mean? Each capillary is small. You know that capillaries are the smallest blood vessels. But there are many of them. I mean many of them. So when you put them all together, which is what you must do in your mind's eye, the total combined capillary cross-sectional area is ginormous. It's huge. And that leads to this fact you should know. Capillary velocity is slowest. That's right, what I just said, the speed of blood flow is slowest in the capillaries. Who cares? I mean, someone just made this up for fun. I mean, let's just design the whole system so that the flow is slow in the capillaries. Just for fun? No. What good is this? Well, take a look down here and just picture it. Here is a capillary going through or to some organ. And remember, the point is in with the good, out with the bad. We want to exchange the goodies and the baddies. If the blood was cruising through that organ at a million miles an hour, we wouldn't have a chance to exchange anything like the gases. So it's perfect that the flow is slowest in the capillaries because that gives us optimum exchange of nutrients and wastes and oxygen and carbon dioxide. Here comes a graph showing you the same thing. No new information, just a graph. Please notice we got a black line. The black line is trying to show you the speed. Notice the speed dipping down the slowest right where I popped up the red star in the capillaries, just like I told you. Notice the green line also showing you cross-sectional area. And again, total cross-sectional area is the most where the capillaries are, because the total cross-sectional area of all capillaries combined is humongous. So largest cross-sectional area, slowest speed, greatest exchange. It all is for a reason. It makes sense. I think this is a great place to stop. Next time we'll hit on some of the main points about some of our major blood vessels. We'll see you next time.